Excited to welcome Charlotte Hornets assistant coach DJ Baker to the basketball podcast. Coach Baker is a seasoned NBA assistant coach and player development specialist with over a decade of professional coaching experience. In 2024, he was named head coach of the Greensboro Swarm, the G League affiliate of the Charlotte Hornets, after serving as an assistant coach with the Milwaukee Bucks during the 2023-24 season. Baker's coaching journey began in 2010 as a video coordinator with the Chicago Bulls, followed by a stint as a regional advanced scout for the Orlando Magic. He later joined the Dallas Mavericks in 2015-16 and the Toronto Raptors 2016-18 in player development roles. From 2018-23, Baker was part of the Detroit Pistons coaching staff under Dwayne Casey, initially as player development coach before being promoted to an assistant coach. He also served as the head coach of the Motor City Crews, Detroit's G League affiliate, compiling a 39-25 record over 2 seasons.
Hey coach, a brief time out from the podcast to bring you the Analytics Minute, sponsored by Hoopsalytics. Do you know which players should be taking what kind of shots? An analytics system like Hoopsalytics can help your team make better shot selection decisions. You can track every kind of shot each player takes, where the shots come from, rate the shot quality, track if the shot was contested, and see the results. For example, see which players are taking mid-range floaters and measure the results versus catch-and-shoot jumpers. As an added bonus, Hoopsalytics shot charts are fully interactive, so you can filter by shot distance, shot type, or even specific areas of the floor. Then watch video clips of all those shots or see the points per shot. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball today. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball. Today to learn more and start analyzing your game for free.
Coach Baker, welcome to the basketball podcast.
It's great to be here with you, Chris. Thanks a lot for having me on.
I'm grateful. We've known each other for a while, and this is long overdue to get you on and to be able to talk basketball and learn from you. And maybe just first start with your coaching journey a little bit, just in terms of some of the different roles that you've filled, including what I love is you've had the experience to be a head coach in the G League.
Yeah, I was actually fortunate enough to start off at Tim Grover's gym in Chicago on the west side of Chicago back in 2009. And that was my intro into basketball and into professional basketball and especially player development. And obviously he was forward thinking and at the front of player development and bringing players in and having them play in the summertime. And so that was my foundation. Thankfully at the time we had so many different NBA guys and so many different events, the NBA Combine and Nike Skills Academy, where so many different players and agents and coaches came in, and that kind of allowed me to step into the NBA space. So I started in the video room, like all of us that didn't play in the league for the most part, and started with the Chicago Bulls there, and then I moved on to do advanced scouting. From there, I did player development, and then I would say two of my big breaks, I would say my career, one was getting to work in the player development program with the Dallas Mavericks. Mike Procopio was the director of player development at the time. Some really good coaches there, Jamal Mosley, Mike Weiner, and obviously Coach Carlisle, Melvin Hunt. So it was a very talented staff. And working there allowed me to get to Toronto because all those Coach Casey had an opening there. And all those guys, obviously, he won the championship there in 2011. And that allowed me an incredible opportunity to get on with him and do video and player development in Toronto. And that's when we had a very young and talented core with Ian Fred Van Fleet and DeLon Wright, Norm Powell, Jakob Poeltl, Pascal Siakam. And it was just a great opportunity to help develop the young guys. And obviously we had a really good nucleus of veteran guys with Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan and Jonas. So we had a good run there. That was great to be a part of that. Followed Coach Casey to Detroit, which was an incredible opportunity. And help run the offense there with Mike Anori and then help run player development as well. And then after 3 years of that, we had the G League team move to Detroit. So I got 2 years of head coaching experience. And I remember when I was with Nick Nurse in Toronto, he told me all the time, go coach in the G League, go be like every week, go coach in the G League. And I was like, okay, I have a really good job now. He said, no, you don't understand. And once I was fortunate enough to do it, I learned the growth and the development from it, how to exposes your weaknesses, how it confirms your strengths and just stretches you in so many different ways from a leadership standpoint, from a basketball standpoint, and really good. And then from there, went to Milwaukee with the Bucks and helped run the offense there. And then I was fortunate enough. A year ago, Coach Lee gave me an opportunity to join the Hornets organization, primarily in the role of G League head coach with the Swarm, and finished up our first year and had a solid year, and looking forward to running it back this upcoming year.
So fun, and I love that Nick Nurse quote definitely. But I think most of his staff is coached in the G League, so he lives it too. He hires people that have coached, and there's such a value to that. And I know you're not the only one that says that. So the opportunity to be able to get all these ideas out and actually try them, there's nothing better. And that leads us to our topic today, DJ, which is talking a little bit about handling switches. Let's maybe start with first, why do teams switch? Because I think understanding that helps us understand how to attack it.
For sure. I think it's really important to understand the why and the how. Why are they doing this? How are they doing this? And then we can give our players solution-based approaches to doing that, to defeating it, executing against it, and recognizing it in game as well. So obviously trying to keep bodies in front of the ball, right? Keep players running into more ISO basketball. The ball stays more stagnant, take away advantage situations, keep the ball out of the paint. Really, well, there's a physicality that teams use with switching of steering or connecting and really grabbing, holding, slowing the offense down and eliminating that freedom of movement. And so when an action happens, whether it's a pick and roll, now the guy that was just guarding the screen or he's grabbing and he's holding him, he's pushing him in to the defender that's on the ball so he can allow him to switch under the ball. And then the guy that just guarded the screener has a chance to aggressively switch up into the ball. And now an action was run offensively and no advantage was created. And there's nothing more frustrating from an offensive standpoint in game when you're running your actions, your sets, and multiple actions are ran and no advantages are created. I think that's why teams do it. And then, like I said, I think the physicality piece and not allowing the freedom of movement is what allows teams to be really good at executing that coverage. And I think really, not to dive ahead, but from an offensive standpoint, I think it's really understanding like how do teams switch? Because some teams like, hey, if two offensive players come close to each other, we're going to switch automatically. Some teams are, hey, we're only going to switch on contact. And I think you have to understand that you can't run early the ghost screens or early slip outs if they're only switching on contact. You know, the tapping the hip won't work. If teams like, hey, if they get close, then you can counter that. So I think it's understanding like why do they switch and how do they switch, but what type of switching team is it? Is it more important for them to switch aggressive on the ball and really pounce and deter the ball handler from getting downhill or shooting that pocket three? Or maybe they're willing to live with the pocket three, but they're really focused on switching under to take away the roller. So there's some generalities to how teams switch, but then it's really each opponent, okay, what are they really looking to take away? And what are their principles to take away from an offensive standpoint?
It's great. I'm glad you went there because how teams switch is obviously important. And you're talking about different coverage solutions relative to how they switch. And the three you gave me, physicality, where they grab and hold, you talked about steer and direct, and then aggressive switch up, switch under. Maybe you talked about grab and hold a little bit. Can you talk a little bit more about steer and direct, and then the aggressive switch up and switch under?
Yeah, I think the steering part is the defensive player wanting. I think from an offensive standpoint, the most important thing is the screening angle. And I think defenses aren't going to let you come from below and set the flat angled screen and allow that pocket pass to open up. So I think the steering piece of it is they want to reroute the screener to screen at a sideways angle so it's easy to execute the switch, to switch up and switch under. So I think that steering, and then I think I mentioned that the switching up is just releasing the screener, and now I'm attacking the ball and kind of making that ball handler retreat and go backwards and not allow A, the pocket three, or A, for him to race in and get downhill. But I think putting a lot of pressure on how the screener sets his screen and what the ball handler sees when that action occurs.
Love that. And we're going to cover these kind of one by one. DJ presented me kind of a list of some absolutes against switching. So let's go through them kind of one-on-one or one at a time, and then we'll dive deeper as we go through. But the first one you gave me, speed crushes switching.
I think offensively, we have to fight for freedom of movement and we have to create indecision. At the end of the day, you have to test how willing a team is to switch. Does a hip tap work? Does a slip out work? Do I have to make contact on the defender? And I think once we define that, then we can do it at a fast pace. The slower we go, the easier it is for them to communicate, the easier it is for them to grab and hold, like we talked about, and you don't create any indecision. At the end of the day, we want to present as if we're running an action a certain way and executing it in a certain way, where the talk is early, and before they know it, there's a slip out or a hit under or a flip screen, different things you can do against it. But I think we want to mess up what they're communicating. And the faster you go, the easier it is from an offensive standpoint, it is, and the harder it is for the defenses to communicate the right thing. So I think like the foundation piece of it is you have to play with speed. And I'm not just talking about the open court, half court. I think it is especially important in fighting for that freedom of movement.
Freedom of movement, obviously a big part. If you can expand on more, is just how can we help the screener arrive alone, which I know is a big part of this.
That's got to be the mindset and the mentality for our screeners. And it only has to be one step off of the defender. We only have to find a way to get him one step off of your body, because that allows the pocket three. That allows the offense player to race it. And sometimes it's sprinting, just sprinting into it. He's off your body, you can sprint into it. Sometimes if he is connect, there's a lot of teams are going into knockoff screens before they run an action, right? Where there's a pin down, you knock off my defender, and now I have that freedom of movement to sprint into it. Wayne Ellington was unbelievable at this. I worked with him in Detroit. It was like a go, stop, go movement where he sprints 3 steps. That defender is starts initially attached, and then he stops on a dime, and they bump into you and bump right off, and then you go. So it's like a go, stop, go movement. So if they're off the body, we sprint. If you want to bring another player into it, there's a knockoff screen. And if you feel like he's still attached, then you probably got to use the go, stop, go. And then I would say the last part of it would be a flip screen, because if he's riding you into the action, and then at some point he's going to release off your body, and the second he releases, I think that's when, okay, that's your freedom of movement comes really late, and that's when you have a chance to flip the screen. So those 4 areas would be what I would focus on, teach, and emphasize in order to let the screeners arrive alone and give them little different tricks to do it.
Great stuff. Knockoff screen, like a RAM screen, we used to call it in terms of screen the
Yes.
screener to the screen, just for people referencing. Love that term, by the way. And then again, you referenced the reason why people switch is to remove advantages. So we're trying to create advantages, and that's ultimately the goal. So talk about how we screen, how we hand off to adapt to their coverage.
Yeah, I think, and it really matters where the screener is coming from. If the screener is coming from below, are they coming from across, like more of a side pick and roll, or are they coming from above, where maybe it's a drag situation? And so I think in each one of those circumstances, the screener has to recognize, okay, here's my read. And so when I'm coming, but at the end of the day, the screening angle is by far to me the most important piece of it, because it changes the angle and it changes your footwork. And again, you have to understand, are they switching on contact, or are they switching when two offensive players are close? And when the two offensive players are close, how close is close? And that's where you have to really push the envelope of, let's say there's a handler at the top of the floor at the 3-point line in the mid pick and roll. As a guy is coming from the bottom of the floor, can he peel out at the college three? Can he peel out at the high school three? Can you peel out at the free throw line? How close is that? I think like the screeners have to understand like how much pressure can we put on the defense for them to honor their principles of, hey, we switch when two offensive players get near themselves. And then there's other times, and I think all this goes into reading the defender's feet. If that defender has square feet on the ball, a slip out or a hip tap is not going to work. That is when you know you have to initiate contact and set a screen, and that screen has to be flat so the on-ball defender cannot switch under. And if you see more of an open stance, the feet are open, the head's turning, the eyes are moving, that's the great slip roll opportunity or slip pop situation. So I think reading the feet, reading the eyes, reading if the on-ball defender's engaged and he's locked into the ball, you're gonna have to give him a lot more than a hip tap. So I think reading the angles in the on-ball defender and really testing the defense's principles on how they switch, I think all of those go into how to create advantages and what we're trying to teach the screeners.
The depth of this, you're already showing it, but there's a complexity to this that we have to make simple as coaches. That's the challenge, isn't it? So maybe let's use screening angles because you've already referenced them many times as being critical. But maybe give us an example, if you could, of how we can simplify something that's so complex to be able to help a player understand when and why they should change an angle.
Yeah, I think the ultimate, starting with the end in mind, is we have to create player recognition in the game. There's maybe at a timeout we can tell them what's going on, but they have to recognize, okay, a small ball five just checked into the game. This team now went from switching one through four, and now they're switching one through five. And the players, our end goal as teachers and as coaches, is to get player recognition and then players becoming adaptable to, hey, I was just sitting and holding my screen and forcing the chase over and getting the hit. And now, okay, I don't want my feet to come to a stop and I want more slip out type actions. So I think starting with that end in mind is what we're presenting to our players. This is what we're looking to do. We're running the same plays, looking to create just as many advantages as when they're in drop versus a switch. And so I think, like I mentioned, for that screener, repping it and allowing them to get used to, there's a read. There's a read to it, and there's a decision-making component to it where they have to understand, can I read that defender's feet? Kind of like what I mentioned. I think that's probably where I'd start. My foundational piece of it, if I'm a screener, I'm looking at the defender's feet. And that's, I think if they can understand that, I think that's the biggest thing. Screening angle, I think teaching them on the ball, not allowing the defender on the ball to release and get under you as a screener. So hitting that back pocket, hitting the low side of the defender, exaggerating it and going to more of a flat screen, I think is really important. I like the flat screens because it allows the ball handlers to pick and choose what side he wants to use to go off the right or the left. And I think the positioning for where the screener initially starts, if you can start with your head under the rim and come up as flat as you can, that's the ideal situation because now it's hard to understand, okay, is he going to flip it right or left, or is he just going to set it flat, initiate contact, and let the ball handler choose and play to a strong hand? So I think I would start with those basics of a screener, like where's your positioning, reading the defender, and then at the last point of it is like, who are my teammates? Is it a heavy right-hand driver? Is it a reject opportunity if it's an empty corner situation? What side of the floor are we on? And it's sounds complex, but I think it's just teammates playing with each other and getting used to each other and repping this out as much as possible.
I love that. And I love the two ways. And I know we're jumping ahead a little bit, but the two ways, one of them is an absolute, which is you feel in practice working versus switching one to five is one of the best ways to be able to develop this. So talk about that first, and I'll get in the second way that you feel is important to develop this.
Yeah, I think even if that's not a defense that you run from an offensive standpoint or from a defensive standpoint, excuse me, like you have to rep it out live because if they don't feel it live, then when they go up against it for the first time in the game, that's not a situation we want to put our players in to be successful. We as coaches have to provide the solutions with clarity. This is what the defense is doing. These are the couple counters that we want to really hone in on. And it's just two or three max. Until we really master those, then we can move on. And then from that standpoint, it's repping it out over and over again, where it really becomes second nature to our players, where they understand, okay, I see the switch, I'm going to look to do this. I see the switch, I'm going to look to do this, and really drill it and ingrain it into their minds. And then after that, there has to be the reads, there has to be the decision making, which obviously you do such an unbelievable job of speaking about that I've learned a lot about and I've stolen honestly from you. But letting our players, once we've taught it, once they've repped it, now there's that decision-making component of, all right, the read was this. You didn't give them this look. And so I think that's really important. And then once all of that happens and it's all great stuff, it has to be live player on player body. They have to feel the physicality. They have to feel the speed. Coaches on defense are a great thing, but there's only a, sometimes the offense has to slow down because the defense isn't live with the coaches. So I think there's no way to replicate it. So again, I would just double down on, even if that's not your base defense of switching one through five, or you have any concerns of, hey, we're going to build bad habits with this, the only way to be prepared from an offensive standpoint is to go live one through five. And I would do that for on the ball and off the ball as well, because I feel like a heavy emphasis is on ball, and I think the off ball is obviously equally as important when teams start switching in your delay actions or whatever you might be in.
Absolutely. We want to get into that off the ball a little bit here. And another thing, again, we know this reference from the NBA that you don't have a ton of practice time, but sometimes doing this 2-on-2 is also an effective way to just be able to educate them about the possibilities with that. Maybe using, you gave me the example of handler reads versus switching with big. So can you give us some of the examples of different ways out of 2-on-2 we can work on that?
Yeah, and I think to your point, every single day this should be worked on in small group settings. Whether it's ideally it's pre-practice, guys want to shoot and get their shots up after practice, which is completely a good thing. But I think pre-practice, even if it's an individual day where it's okay, like, hey, I really want to work on the individual vitamins and work on a guy's jump shot or this or that. If he gets a 25-minute time period, a 30-minute time period, I'm doing the last 5 to 7 to 8 minutes. I'm bringing the couple of players on the court together because in order for them to execute the skill that we're growing them with, if they can't do it with their teammates, with one other teammate, with a two-man action or a three-man action, it really doesn't matter. And so I think that has to be a daily focal point of your player development program and building out your team concepts. And you're still working on the individual skill of the player. And for the handlers, I think the first one we're looking for is the race. You know, understanding a lot of times you're going to have a bigger defender switching onto you. Let's say a five's running into it. What's our advantage? It's our foot speed and it's the ability to race the big. And so, as the defender is coming up and he's switching onto the ball, is beating him to that outside foot. And I think really creating an open stance on the defender, and there's our advantage. And I think when you're working on your finishing, especially if it's a guard versus a big, you have to think shoulder to chest and eating up that space. Because if you race and you have a step up on the big, a step ahead on the big, if you don't initiate contact to create separation, even if it's a smaller guard, and Kyle Lowry was unbelievable at cutting off the bigs and Fred VanVleet, they're just going to get back into play. Even if they're a step behind, they're going to get that block from behind. So once you're racing it and that defender drops his outside foot, which again, the guards are going to have the advantage in this situation, don't just race them and try to beat them to the rim. Race them shoulder to chest to create that advantage. And then you're going with your different finishing packages. So I think the race is really important. I think the reject is really important because the defender that's on the ball at some point in the action, he is going to release off the ball and he's going to work to get underneath the screener. And I think one hard setup of taking one dribble at the action, he releases. I think the reject is a terrific option as well because there's going to be that split second where he leaves your body and you got to make a quick decision to get downhill. And then I think there's a concept that Jrue Holiday was unbelievable with this is driving it back. And if you can picture it with me, I come off the mid pick and roll to my right hand and the screener popped to the left wing. Now I'm on the right wing. Is that defender switched onto the screener and he's chasing him out. And you can really attack the guy that switched onto you one dribble and you can snap it right back with the crossover. And there's going to be that quick driving gap for half a second. And so I think the driving back the screen, driving back the switch is a terrific option. I think the pocket three, obviously, teams are, and you're seeing more and more players like work on the shot and be able to knock the shot down. Before, it was only the high level players are shooting the above the break off the dribble threes. And it's not really a complex three in the sense that you don't need much footwork and you're really gathering. You don't want to go too far off the screen where you're running into that defender that's switching onto you, but you need to take a little bit of a dribble off where the defender that's on you left your body and he's going underneath the screener. So you're almost stopping behind the screener. And I think that pocket three is there a lot because it's really hard for the defender to steer and direct the defensive screener or the offensive screener and hold him up for his teammate to get under the screen. And then switch up on the ball. You understand what I'm saying?
Yep.
So there's that half second where he's steering, he's holding him up, and no one's on you. You gotta be able to hit that three. And I think the last one, I think this is really important, is just ball movement. Get the five onto the ball and just move the ball. Just go a quick swing action and drive a closeout because I feel like two things happen. When the five gets on the ball, most teams want to take away that three and make the man that's handling a driver. They would, the worst thing is the five sitting back underneath the 3-point line and the ball handler just teeing up a three. So that big presses up a little bit. Because that big presses up a little bit, they have an aggressive and early low man. That low man is anticipating the drive and the blow by. So the ball handler, if you can just come off the screen, engage the five, and swing it again, I think the two passes out of the switch is really important. Not one, it's the second pass that's going to force the long closeout. And now we put the big in an uncomfortable situation. He's now guarding out on the perimeter off the ball, and a drive is occurring. And what are most bigs going to do? They're going to feel comfortable in the paint. They're going to feel comfortable helping at the rim. So the big's either going to be late at the rim, and we have our finishing package, or the big's just going to completely leave his man, go into emergency mode into his mind, and go help at the rim. And now we're playing our drive and kick game. Maybe you don't have an overly talented ball handler. I love come off the pick and roll, get the five on the ball, swing it, drive the close out, and now you're put. You they either have a no rim protection, or they're going to be in scramble mode on the perimeter.
I know there's a lot there. I'm not discounting that. It's awesome detail. One of my big takeaways from hearing you talk about all that is sometimes the simplest solution is to move it versus the two. And that's what stands out to me. And I think that's something that can be highlighted. If you don't have players that can handle some of the complexity of these different things, that's one of, say, the two ways I would teach. For you personally, what would be the easiest way to teach something at the point of the ball?
In terms of what my favorite options are.
Yeah, let's say it's a high school coach and they can go two options here. They're going to remove some decision fatigue and say, hey, let's do what you just said. Let's move it and versus, okay, let's do this.
Yeah, it's definitely the swing is number one, because I want to promote ball movement. I want to promote quick decisions, and I want to promote the ability to drive closeouts and closeout reads. So
Love
that
it.
to
Yeah.
me by far is number one. I think number two is like just starting with the race. Like at the high school level, the pocket threat might be a little bit tough. A reject might be a little bit tough. But I think starting with the race, because you're going to win the foot speed battle. The guard is going to, for the most part, the guard's going to have better foot speed than the big that's switching onto him. So I think so many times you see the ball handler come off the pick and roll, get the five switched on him, and he just bounces it out. And he lets them get in their shell and they square up on the ball. So no, let's think in attack mode. Let's not let them square up the ball. And I think if you can take advantage of your foot speed and that type of mentality, like we're going to have an aggressive approach against the switch, I think from there, now you can build out what the guards can actually do.
I love that. It speaks to something. I, again, credit to whoever said this ages ago, but the defense is either lazy or wrong. And we can make them wrong on offense, but generally the first approach is just to assume they're lazy. And that's what your swing, let's attack type of thing kind of highlights to that. And really the second one's the same to a certain extent. It takes a lot of work for a defender to prevent the ball from turning the corner on a switch.
Yeah, no question.
I know when we switched defensively, we were obsessive about trying to force it back where it came. And yet, yeah, sometimes we lost the race.
I just think the worst thing is the ball handler not being in attack mode, coming off, allowing the switch to happen. Now we just ran an action and no advantage was created. And I think changing the mindset and mentality of the ball handler of this is how we're going to make teams pay and still play in advantage mode. So one of the options, they get off the ball. The other option, they get downhill and play in attack mode. So I think you're giving them two different looks.
Hey, coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know, the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
Let's talk about the off the ball. Let's make sure we get to that then. Talk to me a little bit about off the ball reads versus switching.
Yeah, I think again, our foundation is speed crushes switching. So whether you're on the ball, off the ball, half court offense, offense after a dead ball, it doesn't matter. Every action we do has to be done with speed. And so if you just think about a common action, whether it's elbow splits or a five out delay action, whatever's more common for you, it's going to be the same thing. If we're playing in a five out delay action and I hit the trail big in the center of the floor, we have to sprint to screens. And that's for on ball and that's on off ball. And I think in the delay action, now we're talking more about the guards setting that corner split. They have to understand we're demanding the same level of execution versus switching as we are with the bigs. We just talked about the bigs have to arrive alone and create separation. We have to do the same thing. And I think testing how teams switch off the ball, it's the same exact thing. If two offensive players come close to each other, can I slip out and go? Or do I have to make contact? And so I would say the first one, as I'm coming down to set that corner split, I want to, at some point, my defender is going to get on my high side. And I think it's the screener slipping in between the two defenders and slipping to the basket. I think that first and foremost, but it only can happen with speed. If I hit the big and my first three steps are a sprint, I have a chance to get that defender on my high side where I can slip between the two defenders. If my defender stays between myself and the basket, that no longer is an option. And so speed allows that look to happen. Obviously, in a delay action, the rip screens are really important. And I like to say rip and slip. And so now, as the guard hits the trail, the guy out of the corner, same exact thing. He is sprinting to the guard that's at the top. And again, the screening angle that we're teaching is identical to what we talked about prior with the big setting it flat. The reason why I like the rip screens and the flare screens is because the defender that you're screening typically does not have vision of the screen and where it's coming from. And so I think the sprint down and slip out is good, but if you can screen from more angles where that defender has to turn his head or has poor body position to switch under, those to me are like gold. Those are the primary situations. So if we can rip and slip, that'd be great. Now, again, how we rip and slip is so important. As the ball is on the flight, as the ball is on the flight of the pass to the big, you have to sprint out of the corner. And those first three steps out of the corner are huge. And then it's the same exact thing. Reading that defender that's guarding the wing offensive player, is it a touch and go? Do I have to set it flat and hold it? Do I have to just get close and then slip out? And then that's where the decision making would get used to. And on a coaching standpoint, we got to scout the team to let them know, hey, here's what we're going to have to look to do specifically this game to attack their switching. It's our same action. We're still going to rip and slip tonight, but hey, we don't even have to get close to the defender. Hey, we know we're going to have to set it flat and really make contact and then hold and seal. Those are two that I love. And then I think the other one, the third one I would say, is for that guy in the corner. As he sprints in, after you've set that rip and slip screen a few times throughout the game, he is sprinting into that rip screen. And same thing, at some point, his defender is going to leave his body and he's going to take the one that just passed it to the trail. And the second he leaves your body, now you have that freedom of movement that we talked about. And once that freedom of movement is talked about, we do the flip screen, the hook screen. And now the one man that made the pass to the trail, instead of him coming off the rip screen, he's now taking one step down. The offensive player's coming around. He's hooking it. And now the one guy's coming right back to the ball. And ideally, you have both defenders on one side of the screen. So I think those three in a delay situation are very good. I think if you want to talk about splits quickly, I think same thing. If I'm the one and I make the pass to the elbow, as I'm sprinting towards a high split situation, I'm looking for the slip, just like we talked about in the delay situation. Three steps down, my guy gets ahead of, or my guy gets on my high side, I'm gone straight to the rim. Same mentality with the splits. I'm taking three-step sprint towards the defender or my offensive teammate. I'm looking to screen his guy. Once I feel my defender leave my body and get on my high side, I'm going straight to the rim. It would be the first one I'm looking there. And I think the other way, and again, this goes back to the flares and the rips. If the one makes the pass to the elbow, as opposed to him making the splits, being the guy that initiates the splits, I think it's the guy off of the ball that makes the splits because now he's coming in from an angle where you can rip and slip from that angle. And I would prefer that. I think that's more effective because, again, if I'm guarding the ball and the guy passes to the elbow, my eyes are on my defender right in front of me. And now the screen is coming from behind me or on my low side. I'm blind to the screen. Once I'm blind to the screen, I can't switch under. So I think a lot of times when you go elbow splits, bring the high guy over and have the guy that didn't make the pass be the guy that makes the back screen. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, and I can visualize a lot of these things. And I've had an advantage of some of you coaches sharing these things with me directly, which helps me understand them and see them. But particularly the rip and slip, to me, that seems like one of the easiest ones to be able to have players understand. Just again, it's essentially sealing your check to a certain extent. And in addition to just slipping, that both of those can be effective. And it tends to take advantage of what we said before, which is lazy defense that doesn't get back under the right side. And that's typical. And I imagine that's typical mainly versus teams that switch a lot rather than a situational, this is a one-time switch where their attention might be more focused.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I love this. DHOs. Is there anything different on DHOs or do we treat them similar to ball screens?
No, so I think our mindset and mentality, and I'd like to talk about guard-to-guard DHOs, and then I was also like to talk about if a big is doing it, because if teams are running like a guard-to-guard dribble action, I think same exact thing. We want to think, let's talk about corner DHO. We still want to think about the initial 45 attack or the initial slot drive has to be our mentality. We're not looking to go in a straight line on the DHO where I'm at the wing and I'm just going to dribble over to the corner. I think we want to do it with as much speed and aggressiveness as possible, where we're getting inside the 3-point line and really testing the guy that's guarding the ball. If we do that, it is going to force the corner defender to be in a heavier shift and more help, even if they're not giving up the strong side corner three. We know that. But he's going to be in a bigger presentation off of the ball. And now that sets us up to beat the switch. So the guard to guard, the first thing I'm thinking about is 45 attack. It doesn't happen. I get cut off, but the guy in the shift helps or plays a role in me getting cut off. And I just pitch it to the guard. And it's the same option as we did against the bigs. Race it. The first option against the red to me is racing it. Why? Because I have a head of steam and I'd like to flip it. Don't hand it off, flip it, especially if he's off the body. And if you do the 45 attack, the defender's off the body. If he's off the body, the flip's available. If the flip's available, the guy at the corner can run through that ball as quickly as he can and beat the defender to his outside foot again. And we're going shoulder to chest. So I think that's extremely important. It has to be a 45 attack on every DHO. It has to be inside the 3-point line. You have to force the defender that's in the corner off the body. That's the foundation for everything from a DHO standpoint. And once you do that, now we can go through, okay, racing it is really good. Number two, if I make the 45 attack and I back up my defender, he's going to have an extremely hard time of switching up onto the ball. So I think that pocket three is very, and take a step back. These all fall in line with what we're teaching with the pick and rolls, whether it's small with the big. So when you're talking about player recognition and players like grasping these concepts, we're teaching the race, we're teaching the pocket three, we're teaching the split, we're teaching these in pick and roll and DHO. So hopefully there's great carryover in the simplicity of the continuity of what we're teaching, just as a side note. But I think the pocket three is the second one. It's going to be really hard for that on-ball defender to switch up. And then obviously think about the corner split or the corner split that we talked about in delay where the defender gets on the high side and I slip to the rim. It's the same thing with the DHO now, right? It's just a keep, right? As soon as my defender gets on the high side of me, right? Now I'm going to look to keep, but it's with the speed. So all of these things fall into each other. I just happen to have the ball in my hands and that's how I get to the rim as opposed to the big having it and I slip out and I get the catch for the layup. So I think if you focus on the race to maintain that aggressive mentality, I think if you do a great job on the 45 attack and you toss it back, now you have the pocket three. And I think if you do it with speed and aggressiveness and the defender gets on the high side, same thing we're talking about with splits and the corner splits, the high splits and the low splits, I'm doing the keeping getting downhill. So I would say those would be the three I'm looking at.
I love that. You gave them the initial structure and then you figured some things out and connecting it to ball screen after that. So it's great. One thing I want to reference on Keep, and probably you don't have this experience because they've experienced it a little bit more, but when I've taught handoff and coverage solutions versus handoffs, particularly switching at the youth levels, I have learned not to teach Keep right away because
No question.
inevitably they want to keep it all the time. Is that the same?
Yeah, for sure. Even at the
Okay.
pro game, if Jalen Brunson does it every game, that's fine. Go
Yeah.
ahead.
Draymond does it every game. It's fine.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So, but yeah, I would say like definitely teaching the race to me is like the foundation because that creates that aggressive attack mentality. Oh, I would say now that we've talked about the guard-to-guard DHOs, I think the big-to-guard DHOs obviously is a huge part of it as well. I think with the bigs, their read is the defender off of the body of the guards. I think that is so important. The guards don't need to set their man up. If their man's in a shrink position, he can just sprint off of the DHO. If he's onto the body, now we got to think the guards have to come off, whether they do a go, stop, go, whether they just do a one step thing. I already referenced Wayne Ellington one time, but he was the best I've ever been around in my NBA career of creating separation. One step in, a slight little bump, and then he's flying off. But if that offensive player, if your guard is coming off clean without a body on him, the bigs have to think pitch and dive. They have to think pitch and dive, where I am tossing it more so in the air and I am running straight through those defenders. I'm not even making contact with the guard. And I think that's really important. Like the bigs' feet should never stop. Now we're thinking speed. We're thinking our feet should never stop. We're thinking about running through the defenders. If that happens, we're going to create the advantage. The big is going to get below both defenders. If he pitches it and he dives right in between, and I think this is so critical for bigs, the guard's job is to immediately deliver that seam pass, that pocket pass right there. And once that happens, the low man's going to be in. And I think the bigs have to land on 2 feet. Once you slip out and create the advantage and you're getting the pass over the top, you're blind to the low man. Because you're trying, your eyes are back and you're trying to make sure you get the catch. I don't know, is the low man late? If it was Kyle Lowry, he'd be right up under you getting a charge. You have to land on 2 feet. And I think if you have balance and early vision, if you got to go chin to shoulder, you got to snap your head as quick as it can, you got to get your eyes up. And that will make quick, efficient decision making because so many bigs, they can create that initial advantage. How many of them can play make now in that 4-on-3 or 3-on-2 situation on the backside? And I think they have to play off of 2 feet. They have to get early vision. They have to play with balance. If we can give our bigs those three things every day in player development, now they can make the finish read over the small. They can make the somebody cuts, or if they have to make the skip pass for the three, I think that's so important for bigs. I think they've done a good job of slipping out, but their development is landing on two, playing with balance and patience and vision.
DJ, obviously, this is an incredible deep dive. I've never done a deep dive like this, so I'm grateful for you doing it and sharing so much and just so many things to connect information for coaches on dealing with switches and why you switch and everything else that goes with it. And before you go, though, I want to ask you, 31-19, best record in organization's history, first ever playoff appearance. Pretty incredible stuff that you did with Greensboro Swarm. That must have been pretty validating for you and all the hard work you put in your coaching journey.
Yeah, thanks for that. But I think a lot of it comes from like the organizational alignment and being around a front office and an NBA coaching staff with Coach Lee that value the G League, that want to develop the Hornet players and take pride in how we did. And so I think understanding how are we going to execute our process as an organization and everybody being aligned to it and ensuring we execute what coach is looking for with our players and two-way players and our different exhibit player, 10 players. So I think it's really a testament to the organization putting around high character players that have the right DNA, the right work habits. And then at the end of the day, to me, I heard this when I started out, if you want to be a great coach, you have to be around great coaches. And so thankfully, I've been with a number of NBA Coach of the Year guys and guys that made playoffs and this and that. And Tim Gergerich is a guy that had a tremendous amount of influence on my career. And he just always was like, you know, coach and teach, be committed to coaching to teaching the details of the game and then being authentic in our relationship with the players. Obviously, we want to build relationships, but at the end of the day, it's to push them It's to hold them accountable. And at the end of the day, it's to develop them to play at the highest possible level. What is the best version of the players that I have, and how can I help them get to where they want to go? And I think all players are looking for clarity and accountability. And so, clarity of what do they have to do to get to that next step in their career, and then accountability of every single day, I'm going to push you and I'm going to demand the most of you because I care about you and I want you to get to where you want to go. And I would just say my fundamental belief around coaching is to be a teacher of the game, provide that clarity, ultimately for the players to have confidence and to be put in the best situation to have individual and team success. And I think if that is the DNA of the coaching staff and myself, then we're going to help our guys get to where they want to go, which is the name of the game.
There's nothing like a Tim Gurkovich quote to help inspire us all. And for those that don't know him, Google and learn. Just incredible. And I remember your time in Detroit being around him too. And that was just a special event for me just to be able to meet him. So I'm glad that had such an impact. And for the rest of it, DJ, thank you. And just thank you for sharing so openly and honestly and so much useful and practical information. And for a lot of us, a lot of bigger deep dive than we're used to on switching. And we all need that because the game is switching nowadays to a certain extent as well. So thank you so much for sharing the game with us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on here with you. I've learned so much from the content that you've put out there, the videos, the podcasts. I've learned a lot. So I'm happy that I could give back to a certain extent and hopefully provide some value.